from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, as the 2012 presidential campaign nears its climax, political rhetoric is at a fever pitch and fact checkers are busier than ever. Are politicians bending the truth more this year than in past elections? And where's the line between political hyperbole and flat out lying? And how much do voters really care? We'll hear from experts and we'll hear from you. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A great deal of attention has been given to remarks by Governor Mitt Romney's presidential pollster, Neil Newhouse, who said, and I'm quoting, "We're not going to let our campaign be dictated by fact checkers." Top officials in both the Romney and Obama camps have confirmed the need to go negative in this increasingly contentious campaign, regardless of half-truths, and higher-ups in the campaigns of both sides have scoffed at fact-checking, arguing that reporters and voters don't seem to have the necessary attention span or simply don't care enough. How important are the facts in this campaign, and what can the public believe is true when it comes from the mouths or pens of the nation's politicians and their campaigners? And does the public care? We'll tackle all of that and more in this hour, all about fact-finding and finding the truth in this political season. And first, we go to the nation's capital and welcome Eric Wemple, who is an opinion blogger with the Washington Post. Eric Wemple, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
I guess the first question is, with more money in this campaign than ever before, does that mean there's more fact-bending and more distortion of facts?
I just think that there's a couple issues that the issues are terribly wonky. So you have these issues about Medicare, and you have issues about the national debt, and there are these plans, there's competing plans, and there is quite a lot of space for you to bend facts, bend figures, and bend reality. Because what you're talking about is terribly complicated to begin with. And so there are these issues here that lend themselves, I think, perhaps more than in previous campaigns, to some chicanery.
Especially when you throw out a figure like $716 billion, right?
Correct. And, you know, and that one is a trip into the abyss, right? I mean, because they say, oh, that was not actually cut in services, it's a cut for payment providers, and then they come back and say, well, Ryan proposed that as well, and they say, no. And it's just at some point, I think that they're hoping that the voters just announce a draw. I don't know.
Well, with all this wonkiness and chicanery, what about the role of the voters in this? I mean, particularly those voters who are undecided, do they really care enough, and can they sift through all this?
Well, I think that a lot of the fact-checking is very helpful in doing so. I mean, I think that some of these sites, factcheck.org, PolitiFact, and some of the networks, CNN, so on and so forth, are doing some pretty good work. CBS2 did a huge fact check on the Clinton speech. I think it's there for maybe the first time. I mean, I don't remember having, you know, it is set aside from the rest of the coverage. It is sort of in its own little cloud, its own little funnel, but it's there for and all the wonk and all the explanation. It's really explanatory journalism. It's there if they need it, and it's getting clicked on a lot.
I know it's there, and there are apps now, and there's the Truth of Meter. In fact, we'll talk with Bill Adair about the way that works for PolitiFact, but the problem seems to be that underlying all this is just an unwillingness of the campaigns to simply tell the truth in an unvarnished way, as opposed to hyperbole, exaggeration, deception, and outright mendacity.
Well, right. No, there is, you know, Biden's speech was pretty well trashed. Ryan's speech was pretty well trashed. So there's, you know, sort of two peers that by the fact checkers. And it's unclear right now what the consequences are for that. You know, fact checking is not that mature. In other words, you know, it started sort of like several years ago. It hasn't had, you know, decades and decades to harden its place in the public dialogue. So it may take a few more cycles before people really get scared about fact checkers, but it's growing.
We're talking to Eric Wemple, who's with us from Washington. He's an opinion blogger with the Washington Post. And I wonder if what I'm really getting at here is that journalists and voters often let the facts get away from them, or let those who spew out different spins or deceptions as facts simply bypass. Ron Riggio, who's a Claremont McKenna College professor and writes for Psychology Today, said the kind of cognitive laziness and a sense of a voter saying, well, this is my bias, so this is what I believe, regardless of whether the facts have been checked or not. In other words, apathy, and politicians themselves probably self-deceived.
Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of truth to that. I don't know. It's a little bit too early to tell what the impact. Who knows? Ryan took quite a beating in the Republican convention. Who knows whether the Democrats sort of huddled together and say, "Hey, we need to be a little more responsible here."
Did he take a beating mainly because of the marathon run, do you think, as opposed to the Medicare things like that?
Well, I think that one was actually quite a whopper, and I think running enthusiasts and anybody who's ever run a race will tell you exactly why. And the notion that Paul Ryan laughed that one off. I don't think that wouldn't withstand the look of any running fact checker.
Eric Wemple, again with us from Washington, opinion blogger for the Washington Post. So good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And let me tell you who else is going to be with us. Professor Barbara O'Connor, Emeritus Professor of Communications with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media at Cal State Sacramento, and National Board Member proudly of the AARP. Welcome, Barbara O'Connor.
Thank you.
We also have with us for this hour Dan Ariely, who is a professor of behavioral economics and has been on Forum before. He's a professor at Duke University, author of The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. He's with us this morning from Stanford. Dan, good to have you back.
Pleasure to be back.
And we also want to welcome Eugene Kiley, who's deputy director of factcheck.org, who is joining us this morning on this Forum hour. Good morning, Eugene Kiley. Oops. I'm sorry. We'll get Eugene Kiley on. We also have Bill Adair with us, editor of PolitiFact and Washington bureau chief for the Tampa Bay Times, who's with us from Tampa. Actually, with us from Washington, I think. Bill Adair, good morning.
Correct. With you from Washington.
Good to have you with us as well. I want to go to Barbara O'Connor. And Barbara, you've been out in some of the swing states. Is it worse than it's been in the past, you think?
It's different. I was listening to Eric and agreeing with everything he was saying. People are more issue-centric, and when you look at the rising number of independents, I think that's an indice that people need to look at more carefully. Because the people that I talk to, and we've been in swing states, I just came back from a week in Virginia, they're very tired of the PAC ads and the untruth. When you talk to them, and I was at a NASCAR race, so spent a day, on Saturday, it's very interesting. They do care, and they care very much about these wonky issues. I haven't asked them, and I'll start doing that just out of curiosity, whether they're paying attention to the fact checkers. But they certainly care about the issues more than I've ever seen on both sides. And so I agree with Eric that I think while it is a new phenomenon, certainly journalists are using fact checkers extensively, and I think it will permeate the election. And moreover, I think we'll see more people actually watching the debates than we've ever seen.
There is the argument, however, that journalists don't tackle a lot of the facts for fear of appearing biased. So, that idea you should be neutral, the view from nowhere and all that.
Well, and when you talk, all these lists that I'm on, some of which are Republican lists and some of which are Democratic lists, they dismiss the fact checkers because of bias. But I think increasingly there are more neutral people who are trying to do a very, very good job of vetting, coming down with arguments and evidence to support their fact check. And over time, that will take hold. And I think, as I said, I think the debates themselves will have wider viewership than we've ever had.
Well, what do you think is going on here, though, in terms of the campaigns? Is it more evasion or outright lying? I mean, are they white lies? Or are they simply shirking truth or dodging it and saying things out of context, spinning it differently? Or are we talking about outright mendacity?
I think some of both. I agree that Paul Ryan telling us about his running time, surely he knew the answer to that. So that was more braggadocious probably than anything else. But I do think that it's shading, tracking polls and coming up with spin labels that will attract a viewer. And what it's doing in the places I'm going to is they're just turning off everything. I think people really do realize there's a lot of untruth out there and they don't know who to trust.
Well, and the fact of the matter is there are different sets of facts. Right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true on Medicare and Social Security, which is what I've been talking a lot about.
And what do you find, again, we're talking to Barbara O'Connor, who's Emeritus Professor of Communications with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media at Cal State University in Sacramento. In terms of third parties or super PACs, perhaps lying more rampantly or more pervasively than the candidate-sponsored ads. I know, for example, that there's been a lot of brouhaha about the woman who died by cancer, supposedly because of a layoff of her husband at Bain Capital, and this was essentially engineered by a PAC ad.
Yeah, that's correct. And let me tell you, we're very glad we live in California because in Virginia and in Colorado, they're highly targeted to the economics of the region and what they know are biases of the voters. And they're very short, they're very snazzy, and they're simple labels with no support. So, yes, they are doing more than just shading the truth. They're picking and choosing what they want to emphasize.
And what about when you hear ads over and over again that President Obama has taken work out of work and welfare? The public kind of gets inured to that to the point where they believe it's true, even though it's not true.
Actually, I don't think they do. I'd argue with you because I just talked to about 500 people over the weekend. Even if they're not supporting Obama, they don't come back at you with those lines. It's a much more personal, regional, specific discussion that you have with them when you actually talk to them.
And let me go to Dan Ariely, who has studied truth and honesty from a scholarly point of view and written books on it. You know, the sense of exaggeration and falsehood is, I guess, what we're trying to detect here, as well as just how the facts are distorted, Dan. And the fact is, your research shows that people lie more about little things than they do about big things.
Yeah, so the basic finding is that people can very easily tell lies and think of ourselves as honest people. And this ability to create what we think in the social domain is white lies, but actually are just little lies, and fudge the truth a little bit is something incredibly common. So just kind of to give you an example, we give people a chance to steal money from us. So people fill a particular sheet of paper, and then we ask them how many questions you got correctly, count them, go back and shred your piece of paper, and then tell us how many questions you got correctly. And people don't realize, but they don't really shred the piece of paper. They put it through the shredder, but the main body of the page remains intact. They only shred the sides of the page. And what happened is that we find that people basically solve four problems that's reporting to be solving six. And from about 30,000 people we tested so far, we had about 12 big liars, and they stole, you know, each of them stole the maximum amount of money from us, and together they stole $150. And we had 18,000 little cheaters who each of them just stole a couple of dollars, but because there's so many of them, they stole $36,000 from us. So there's lots of this ability to tell little lies. And what's interesting is that not only do people tell little lies, but they think of themselves as good people at the same time. And I'll give you kind of one example for this. We asked about 12 golf players about how they cheat in golf. And we said, you know, what about kind of if your ball fell on the rough, it's not a good place, and you could pick it up and move it 4 inches to the side. And people say, heaven forbid, I've never done this. I can't imagine anybody would do it. It's just inconceivable. And then we say, what about kicking it with your shoe a little bit? Oh, yeah, that's no problem. And what about hitting it with a club? That's even easier. When you do something direct, like, you know, taking money from people's wallets and so on, people feel outrageous about it, and they don't feel morally okay. But if it's downloading illegal software, if it's backdating stock options, if it's all, you know, things about expense reports, telling a story about something else, it makes it easier.
So
now,
when
we move to politics, there's two more things that I think are worthwhile saying. One is that when we did a study on what we call altruistic cheating, and we asked the question, what happens when you stand to gain from your cheating versus when somebody else stands to gain as well? So if you and I are a team, you can imagine what happens when I'm the only one who's gaining from cheating versus what happens when you're gaining a little bit and I'm gaining a little bit as well. Now what happened is people cheat to a higher degree. Why? Because all of a sudden they don't think of themselves as bad people. They think of themselves a little bit like Robin Hoods. And I think in politics this is the case. When politicians lie, they probably don't think to themselves that they're doing it in order to get that particularly elected to that seat, but in fact, they can probably convince themselves that it's for the good of the country, right? If I only got elected, that would be great for you, not just for me. And the last thing I want to say is that we recently did a study about how much dishonesty are people willing to tolerate from their politician. And we basically phrased it, you know, there's all kinds of shady things and half-truth and so on. And how much should politicians engage in that? And people basically said that their own politician, the person they want to win, should engage in a lot of it. And the person on the other side should not engage in it at all. That it's unacceptable for the other side of the political spectrum to engage in such shady activity, but their own politicians, that's perfectly reasonable. And I think what we have here is kind of a chicken and egg problem. If you have a system that you think is corrupt and you think lots of lying and back dealing and all kinds of immoral things are going in there, how do you want your politicians to behave? You want your politicians to be kind of part of the system, because if they're too honest, they're not going to be effective in it. So we have, I think, a belief that people say that the political system is not honest, and therefore you want your politician to be effective, they have to be kind of, you know, backstabbing, is not particularly truthful, and so on, in order to be effective in that. And that creates higher tolerance for dishonesty, which leads to more of it and more of it and more of it, and we're kind of in a really bad cycle from that perspective.
Yeah. Don Ariely again with us this morning from Stanford's campus. He's professor of behavioral economics at Duke and author of The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Sounds like, I remember years ago, Dan, reading Cecilia Bach's book on lying. The whole society is kind of geared toward perhaps some forms of prevarication and mendacity, even on a small level. But particularly when you get into the big stakes of politics, you're suggesting that, and as partisan and polarized as it is, and the stakes are much higher, lying is going to be it's going to be on a higher plane, so to speak, or a lower plane.
Yeah, and once we get used to a certain level of cheating as socially acceptable, people don't feel bad about it. So just contrast in your mind two things. So ask yourself, how bad would you feel going to a restaurant somewhere and just getting up and not paying the bill? And by the way, the last 2 years, every time I've gone to a restaurant, I ask the waiter if he can recommend a way for me to eat and not pay. Like, how could I escape if I wanted to escape without paying? And, you know, they usually worry a little bit in the beginning, but I tell them, look, I'm not going to do it. I just want the advice. And aside from one place, they always have great suggestions of how to do it. So it means that it's easy to do, but almost nobody does it. And just think to yourself, what you would be confronted with is your own guilt feeling about not doing it. What about illegal downloads? No guilt whatsoever. And what's causing us, what's stopping us from being honest and dishonest, it is not so much the fear of being caught, and it's not fact checkers, and it's not prison. It's not even death sentence, by the way. And of course, it's not the three strikes and you're out that is so popular in California. People don't think about the long consequences of their actions. Instead, it is the how bad would you feel at the moment about being dishonest. And what happens is that as it becomes more and more prevalent, it becomes more and more part of the social norm. And once it becomes part of the social norm, you don't feel bad about it.
Now, let me take that point, because I want to bring Bill Adair in this. He's editor of PolitiFact and Washington bureau chief for the Tampa Bay Times, and PolitiFact is known for its truth-o-meter. They essentially look at the promises made by the president, the promises made by congressional leaders, and how much those promises are hewed to or kept. I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you, Bill Adair, is just how important is the truth to the public as far as you found it?
Well, it's obviously critical that both sides be talking about, as they talk about issues, that there be an understanding of what's true and what's not. And I think in order for our democracy to function, we need to have some agreement on what the issues are, what the problems are, how bad they are, things like that. And, of course, exaggerating and falsehoods have long been a part of American politics. I mean, this is nothing new, as we've been talking about. But I think what's different this time around, and you were asking earlier about, you know, is it worse this time? I think what's different this time is there are so many different sources of information. It's not just TV ads anymore. People are getting things from emails, from chain emails. They're getting them from social media. They're getting them from robocalls. That, you know, there seem to be more robocalls than ever. And all these things are bringing messages that don't go through a filter, that in many cases are not getting the scrutiny of fact checkers and need it. So I think there's a good reason that there is so much more fact-checking, in that I think there are so many more messages from so many different places.
So what's the influence of the fact-checkers? You've got 36 reporters out there digging their heels in, working hard to get at the facts, and I have to ask, what's the impact or influence on, for example, undecided voters?
Well, we don't know the answer to that because there has not been any real good research into that. And I would argue that, you know, I would expect it's going to be on the folks in the middle, the people who are have strong partisan leanings either way are probably not going to accept a message that says, hey, your guy was wrong. But I think those folks in the middle are more persuadable. That's what the campaign strategists call them, the persuadables. And I suspect that the research will show they are more receptive to a fact-checking message. Now, it's important to understand, my goal as a fact-checker is not to get politicians to stop lying. It is to inform democracy. So we want people who read PolitiFact and see our Truth-O-Meter ratings to come away with valuable information. We don't expect they're going to agree with that every time. We're making judgment calls, and I think it's natural, just as with an umpire in baseball, you're going to disagree with a call here and there. Probably for the most part, you'll agree with most of them. But I hope that voters come away from our work informed about what the issues are. Eric was mentioning the Medicare attack ad we've heard from so many in so many states. So-and-so cut $700 billion from Medicare, and we've consistently rated that a pretty significant exaggeration. But that's one where, you know, I hope that people come away from our fact checks with a better understanding. Oh, yeah, that's a big exaggeration.
I just thought, for example, when Paul Ryan, I don't mean to necessarily pick on him here, but when he said in his speech that the stimulus under Obama was the biggest federal expenditure of all time, World War II, but the public seems to need to be apprised of those kinds of things.
Well, I think they do, We, with our Truth-O-Meter, have the unique ability to make those calls and say that statement is half true or false, or our lowest rating, pants on fire. And by doing that, I think we give a snapshot. We gave a false rating to Ryan for his claim that Obama broke a promise to keep the Janesville plant open.
Bill, excuse me, my music is coming up on us here, and that was certainly one of the facts that was hit very hard because that plant was closed under George W. Bush. Is anybody lying more in this campaign from your detail?
Well, we don't keep tabs like that, and our goal is to look at the individual factual claims and rate them, and we'll leave that analysis to the pundits.
All right. I thank Bill Adair, and you can join us with your thoughts. Please do. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio, and as the 2012 presidential campaign nears its climax, political rhetoric is heating up, and fact-checkers are busier than ever. Are politicians bending the truth more this year than in past elections? And we're looking at the line between political hyperbole and flat-out lying, asking how much voters really care. We spoke earlier with Eric Wemple, opinion blogger for The Washington Post, and with us for the hour is Professor Barbara O'Connor, Emeritus Professor of Communications at the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media at Cal State Sacramento, and Dan Ariely, who is Professor of Behavioral Sciences at Duke. We also spoke with Bill Adair and said goodbye to him in the last segment, editor of PolitiFact and Washington Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times. And we want to bring our listeners into this. And if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, we certainly welcome your calls. It's toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our Facebook page or on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And I do want to bring Eugene Kiley into this. He's deputy director of factcheck.org. And Eugene Kiley, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, both sides say that fact-checking is good and necessary, but really, how much are they really, from your judgment, bending to the facts or acknowledging or deferring to the facts, and how much does the public really care? Those are the two central questions here.
Well, in terms of talking about how politicians change what they say as a result of fact-checkers? Because I don't think that they do.
That's really the essence of the question. You don't think there's enough impact of it, no?
No, I don't think that they change their message. If the message is working, and that's something that they check through polling and focus groups and the like, if it's working, they're going to continue to say it.
Regardless of how negative or false or even downright lying it might be?
Yes.
As long as, in other words, their polling shows that people are
that it's working.
Reacting in a the negative ads are working. What about the public's role in this? What do you see as the public's role in this in terms of abiding by what or looking at or investigating what fact checkers call to our attention?
Well, and that's where we come in. I mean, I think what our role is try to help the public cut through the spin and the deceptions, and to provide them with the information that they need to make an intelligent decision. So we're not concerned as much about having an impact on politicians as much as we are hoping to have an impact on the voters.
But if you can't pressure the politicians with the facts, then don't the voters become inured to not getting the facts and sort of accepting and swallowing what they're getting?
Well, no, because I think that when we're seeing that particularly right now is that what we are doing here at Fact Check and with others, including Bill Adair and PolitiFact, who was in your earlier segment, what we're doing is providing the information. And then there are others out there, journalists who are doing the same thing every day as part of what they do on TV and in newspapers and in magazines. Sometimes they'll turn to us and use our material to help support the arguments that they're making or the points that they're making, because what we're doing here is focused just on fact-checking these political statements. And mass media, newspapers and the like, they might not have the luxury to dig into what the kind of level of detail that we're getting into. So what we're doing, it kind of echoes throughout the political chamber. And so hopefully more and more people are getting at the truth.
Well, with your level of detail and the luxury that you've had to go into that level of detail, I have to ask you about the Pinocchio effect here. I mean, are we looking at, say, a longer proboscis from the Republicans than the Democrats or vice versa?
I'm sorry, restate that question.
Who's a bigger liar? Can you quantify that? Which political party is a bigger liar or a bigger distorter of facts?
Yeah. From my perspective, it's not a matter of parties or individuals even. What it's a matter usually of is how close the election is, who's winning and who's trailing. If you're ahead in the polls comfortably, there's no reason to do that. If you're behind the polls, you want to shake up, change the dynamic of the race. And so you may go out and make some of what might seem to us as fact checkers is outrageous claims in order to try to gain the public's attention and to change the dynamic of the race. So I don't think it's the province of any one particular party or candidate.
Well, who checks the fact checkers? Because you can always be accused of bias if you come out with facts, and often are, aren't you?
We're criticized from both the right and the left. So I take that as that we're doing our job correctly.
All right. It's good to have you with us, and I thank you for being with us. That's Eugene Kiley, Deputy Director of FactCheck.org. Let's go to your calls, and we'll begin with Alex from Santa Clara.
Hello?
Yeah. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. So actually, I had a point that I think was relevant to what your guest just said. I'm watching this campaign. It's kind of disheartening to see how afraid I think the media is of getting accused of bias. It seems like the media is trying way too hard to basically appear unbiased, even though in some cases, like, you know, it's not really an equivalent issue. Like, for example, the thing I think of is we all know how Paul Ryan gave his speech at the RNC, and there were a lot of people, a lot of fact checkers came along and said that he was, you know, stretching the truth a bit, and there was a lot of problems with what he said. And then a week later, the DNC happened. Bill Clinton gave a speech, and I think it was the AP who came out and said that, you know, his speech was mostly okay, but we also have to take into account the fact that back when he was president, he lied about Monica Lewinsky. And, you know, I see that, and it's like, what? We're talking about his speech, not what happened 15 years ago. It seems like people are trying too hard to appear, you know, appear like they're grilling both sides when, in fact, you know, one side is clearly being worse than the other.
Alex, you raise an important point, and this is what I referred to earlier as the view from nowhere. Let me bring Eugene Kiley back in to respond to that. And by the way, Eugene Kiley, I'm also looking at an email from a listener, Dave, who writes, even the fact checkers are now being co-opted by the false equivalency problem that is the cancer at the core of our modern media. If PolitiFact or any of its brethren call out Republicans too much, they'll be blasted as being biased, even if they're doing the right thing. The bias charge that the right wing has refined over the past three decades has turned into a cudgel that has bloodied our fourth estate.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to speak to what the Associated Press did in its fact-checking, but I can tell you that we don't fact-check opinion. We're fact-checking facts. And I think what we do is different than what some of the other news organizations do. In having myself worked at newspapers, I know that there is an expectation that you need to, in order to, going into a night like that, like at the DNC, you know, there's an expectation that you're going to be writing about this particular speech. And perhaps, you know, they're going to write about it whether there's something to be said or not. In our case, that particular night when Clinton spoke, we checked 20 different statements, at least 20 different statements that he made, and found that most of them were indeed accurate. And if you go back and take a read on what we wrote on Bill Clinton, there were just a few examples that where we wrote about claims that we thought merited some reporting.
Well, I read that AP piece, and let me bring Barbara O'Connor back into this. The AP piece not only spoke about, you know, Bill Clinton's having said, I did not have sex with that woman, which cast a shadow and doubt over a lot of what he might have said at the DNC, despite its being factual, but mentioned John Edwards and Marion Barry, and mentioned Anthony Weiner. I mean, in other words, mostly Democrats.
No, I read it too and had the same reaction as your email caller. You know, it was irrelevant to the point they were trying to make. It was character assassination, and it was pretty apparent. And I think part of it is what your phone listener talked about, is that I think the media is gun-shy on trying to be unbiased, and they get accused of being Democrats. Well, that's not new. It's been going on forever. But another point I'd like to weave back in is one that Bill brought up, of the kind of overload of information and the real need, I think, at an interpersonal level to get someone to help you sort it. And that's what I keep seeing is, you know, the sort of the need a la Rokeach or Haider or Goffman to have opinion leaders and close friends to talk about this stuff with. And with a 36%, you know, undecided electorate in these key states, I think that's where the ground play is going to be. And I intuitively think that the fact-checking will help.
Well, I'm looking at a lot of listeners weighing in on this, and let me just give you some samples of what people are saying. Mike from Belmont writes, mendacity, prevarication, braggadocio. These words conceal the truth. We're talking about lying. Please just call it that. And Don from Walnut Creek says, Michael and panel, is not the solution that members of the media have guts and start calling politicians explicitly on lies? And I mean actually saying, sir, you are lying and you know it. Yeah. Seems as if members of the media are terrified of using the word lie, and yet the simplest words are often the most powerful.
Linguistically, that's true. I mean, we know it's true. And, you know, I find myself as an academic going into these settings, going back and reading linguistics and Rokic and attitude shaping. And I think that's what's at play with the average voter. It's not the massive expense of money. It's not, they know they're lying. I mean, you look at the popularity ratings of politicians, and they have gone steadily downhill to where they're almost unregisterable. And, you know, I don't think that the public is unaware that the media is ducking some of these issues because they talk about it all the time. The ratings on Newsroom, you know, people cheer at sort of the unvarnished call people liar approach of the Newsroom show.
Well, Dan Ariely, let me bring you back into this because in Shakespeare's day they used to say you lie in the throat. It's difficult these days, I suppose, to use that word. It may, in fact, be a little bit verboten, not only where the public media is concerned, but also, well, not in the UK, but here in the United States, but also among everyday people.
So, you know, I think here's kind of the thing to understand about lying is that the reality is that we all understand that lying is important in life. You know, nobody ever tells their kids or other people that the answer to the question, honey, how do I look in that dress, is only and always the right answer. It's always the truth. And what happened is that we understand that there are trade-offs in life, and that there are trade-offs between, you know, your own feelings and the truth and what other people are feeling and not to hurt them, and there's objective things. And in the social domain, we all understand that these trade-offs are there and they're important, and the truth doesn't always win. The real issue is what happens when you move to the business domain. So while you might not want to live with a spouse that always tells you the truth, you probably don't want an accountant that cares about your feelings rather than give you the truth. And you probably don't want a president that hides the truth from you. But in reality, that the world of politics is somewhere between social life and between business. And I think in business, you know, we should never tolerate dishonesty. In social life, we should tolerate it to some degree because it's an important lubricant of our happiness and so on. And now the question is, where is politics in this range? And what do we really want our politicians? How much do we really want to know? I think there's a saying that says you never want to know how sausages and politics are being made. There's so much ugliness underneath the ground that you just don't want to see. And as we as a public, we have this I think idea about honesty, but we also have lots of things that we really just don't want to know and don't want to think and want to be disassociated from. And because of that, I think we're tolerating a higher level of dishonesty. So
maybe the toleration has something to do with the fact that politicians, and I wonder if you see things this way, perhaps implicitly or explicitly use a sort of strategy where if they're misshaping the truth or spinning the truth in a certain way, or downright lying for that matter, the strategy is depend on the voters sort of throwing up their hands and saying it's a draw.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that basically the voters don't seem to care that much. So
in many instances, I'm afraid that the voters are apathetic, or they say, well, they're all lying, so who can believe what any of them are saying?
Yeah. And you know, and as they lie more, it's easier to lie more, right? So this goes back to the notion of the social construct of how much honesty are we expecting from politicians and what is acceptable. And the moment we accept that politicians are lying, that's a slippery slope. Now,
has anybody ever conceived the idea of demanding that politicians tell the truth? Not so much accepting, but demanding. Insisting.
I haven't seen it, and I think there's a question of kind of what is the acceptable level that we have, and the question is how do we reset it? And let me give you kind of one very different direction on this. And we have done research in which we give people hundreds of opportunities to be dishonest, and what we see is that in the beginning, people are largely honest with some deviations here and there. So from time to time, they cheat a little bit here, they cheat a little bit there, but mostly they're honest. But at some point, they start on a slippery slope, and it just gets worse and worse and worse until they basically stop being honest at all, and they keep on cheating all the time. And we said, okay, so how do you ever stop it? If you're in a system that everybody's always lying and you're always lying, why would you ever stop it? In religious terms, we call it the what the hell effect, right? If you think you're going to hell anyway, why would you ever stop? And we went and we thought about the Catholic confession. Now, you can hear from my accent, I'm not Catholic, but we thought about the Catholic confession and we said maybe one of the things that Catholic confession does is it allows people to open a new page, to have a new start. Because if tomorrow is connected to yesterday, why would you behave very differently? So we've done these experiments with a version of the Catholic confession when we give people a chance to be dishonest. They start cheating a lot. They start cheating all the time. And then we give them a sheet of paper and we said, hey, if you've done anything bad recently, why don't you write it on this piece of paper? And then we ask them to shred it because we don't want to know what they've done. And then we ask them to ask forgiveness from whatever entity and deity they believe in, and they do those. And when they do both of those things, people reset. But if you think about it, I think that for politics to move into a more honest direction, we should have a resetting point. And by the way, South Africa did this with the Reconciliation Act.
They did it in Chile also with reconciliation and stuff. Dan, excuse me, I want to get some more callers on here. But let me do that, if I may, bring Peter on. Peter, good morning.
Yes, hi. I wanted to know the references to fact-checkers and the fact-checkers. I'm wondering exactly what you mean. Certainly, I expect the press, and others have expressed disappointment, too, in the press for not doing the role of fact-checking, which I think they used to do more. Two things particularly that are new. I think much more has to be done with reviewing the actions of politicians rather than their words. Just focusing on their words is to completely leave out a tremendously important and perhaps paramount aspect of their what they do, which is just what have they done. The other thing is, unfortunately, socially and politically, there is a negative sting that goes to the person who calls a lie, or especially calls somebody a liar. Often people remember that somebody said so-and-so was a liar, but they don't remember that it turned out that that was correct.
Yeah, both salient points. Let me go to Eugene Kiley with factcheck.org.
And I'm sorry, what would the question be on there?
Well, that's Peter just bringing up the fact, a couple of facts, but I think one of the things we have to boil down to is the risks that someone takes when they say, you know, you're lying, and say it very clearly and very explicitly, and also the sense of who checks the fact checkers.
Who checks the fact checkers? Meaning what? I don't understand. I mean,
well, if fact checkers are going to be accused of bias and all of that, and some of them perhaps, I'm not in any way casting any aspersions here toward your group or any other group, but some of them may indeed have bias.
I don't know. I could just tell you how we operate and who we are, and how, as trained journalists, we are trained to approach these issues and these set of facts without bias.
But if you approach them in an unbiased way and you call somebody a liar, for example, getting back to Peter's point, you run a certain risk of, I think as he put it, public memory here tends to focus on things like calling someone out as opposed to maybe saying the truth, as opposed to revealing the truth.
Well, first of all, we never call anybody a liar because we're not mind readers here. I mean, we can't say that someone did this deliberately. There are plenty of instances that we come across all the time where information is presented in a way that's true but misleading. There's information that's spun in a way that provides information that makes that candidate look to be in a favorable light. And we will point out that there's another side to this, and here's some more context and information so you as a voter can make up your mind. So we don't say that anyone's lying.
And yet when you essentially reveal what may be the truth, as opposed to something that's been totally distorted, whatever the intention may have been, in effect it says that person was not telling the truth.
Right. We'll say that person's not. We'll say that the information's false. We'll say the information's misleading. We'll say that the information is true, but it doesn't provide all the information that you need to understand the issue. So there are different. You know, I know that PolitiFact does pants on fire and all that. We do that through our own through text rather than a truthometer.
And again, Eugene Kiley is deputy director of factcheck.org. Some of your emails, Robert writes, the media have become lapdogs and for the most part let politicians say whatever they want without challenging them right then. Once the lies are out with no challenge, no amount of post-fact-checking will correct the situation. The media is now just a worthless conduit for lies and people no longer waste their time with it. And Stephen says, There was a revealing moment on NPR a few weeks ago. A reporter was interviewing a Republican voter who repeated the claim that President Obama had gutted the work requirement for welfare. When the reporter told the voter that was incorrect, the voter stated, well, I don't know what's true then, but I do know that I trust Mitt Romney and I don't trust President Obama. And how does one deal with that? Well, you're listening to Forum. We're talking now with Professors Barbara O'Connor and Dan Ariely. Dan Ariely. And Eugene Kiley from factcheck.org is with us as well. We spoke earlier with Eric Wemple of the Washington Post and with Bill Adair, who's with the Tampa Bay Times. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we go to another caller, and that's Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on.
Hi, Michael. Great show. And first of all, let me say I commend the work of the fact checkers. I had a question, however. How did they think, or all of you think it plays in, the kill the messenger thing where the king asks the messenger for information, doesn't like what they hear, even if it was true, but kills the messenger? How do you think that plays in to these politicians not wanting to give facts that are bad because they might be the messenger that gets killed by the public?
What do you think, Barbara O'Connor?
Well, I mean, I think that's the point you were saying about the person who discloses the liar. They also get killed. I think there's truth to that, but we also need a little courage. Intrigued by the idea of, resetting. And that's why I intuitively go back and reread sort of attitude change theory, because it's helping me at the moment. A lot of this is opinion, and I think the salient facts here are there's a huge number of undecideds. And the large percent of the American electorate doesn't trust politicians. They don't like them. They don't trust them. So that's an opportunity, I think, for a reset. And how we do it, I think we work on that. But fact-checking is certainly a part of it. But we require courage on the part of the media and the fact-checkers.
Is there anybody doing fact-checking on their actions, as one of the previous callers said?
No, I think that's a good point. And I was listening. I mean, having coached debate for 40 years, we were always focused on the facts. And I think the press, because of cuts and, organizational shifts, have less people to do that work. And, some of the nonprofit press is doing more of it. I think the fact checkers are doing it. It's a new model, and I'm not going to kill the messenger.
And I thank the caller. Do you want to bring in something here, Dan Ariely?
No, I think people just don't care enough about those things. I think there's a very old literature on misattribution of memories that basically says that people remember something, and when you put more attention to it, they don't necessarily remember the nuances of it. So the worst thing a judge can do in court is to say to the jury, you remember this fact? Ignore it. It's incorrect. And now what happens is people remember it to an even higher degree.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is what is really the psychological effect of fact checkers. People pay attention to a statement, they remember it, and then they have this other note attached to it that says, remember this is not correct. And the question is this note that is attached to this memory actually being effective in getting people to remember that this is incorrect, or actually getting them to pay more attention to it? And we have to have fact checkers, and it's really important. But there is a question of whether it's a right mechanism to do things after the fact rather than to try and prevent them from the beginning. Is it effective to try and come later rather than, for example, to get politicians to commit to the honesty, get them to submit their speeches beforehand to some fact-checking that would give them feedback early on. Is it the right approach to come after the fact and try to fix something rather than to try and fix something earlier? And of course, it's easier, but the question is it effective? And I suspect it's not as effective as we wish it were.
All right, let me get Kathleen in here. And Kathleen, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum.
Thank you very much for the program. Facts do make a difference to me, and there's not enough repeat of the facts by the media or by journalists who talk to these politicians to get that message out, to counter the inaccuracies and to the outright lies. And there's not enough interrogation of people to be able to bring that out. And somebody mentioned earlier about Paul Ryan's running time. That does make a big difference to me because I think it's very telling. He's a man of numbers. He's head of the Budget Committee. And as a result, he has a big impact, but he also should be remembering numbers. In addition to that, he's a staunch Catholic. So I don't know whether or not the situation that they mentioned about this Catholic confession makes a big difference, but the intent of the Catholic confession is not only to unburden your chest or your heart, but also to change your behavior, to be able to do better the next time and not to just move on and be able to repeat and do the same thing.
Right, unfortunately, Kathleen, I have to move on, but I thank you for the call, and thanks to our panel, all those who joined us this morning, Eric Wemple from The Washington Post, who we had on earlier, and Bill Adair from PolitiFact. I want to also thank Professor Barbara O'Connor, who is with us from Sacramento, Emeritus Professor at Sac State, California State University, Sacramento. Dan Arelli, who was with us from Stanford this morning, who's Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke and author of The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, and Eugene Kiley, who is Deputy Director of FactCheck.org. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, and, Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.